When Chicago school children were asked back in 1919 what sorts of films they liked, one responded, "I like educational pictures best, especially those with Charlie Chaplin." I doubt Charlie Chaplin starred in any of the educational films you watched as a kid, but I'll also bet that many of you did watch quite a few in darkened classrooms when teachers were happy for a break. And they were about things like what to do in the case of a nuclear emergency, the life cycle of bees, dealing with tuberculosis, and even race relations. The long and varied history of educational films is celebrated in a new book from Oxford University Press called Learning with the Lights Off, and I'm very happy to be joined now by its three editors, Dan Strebel, along with Devin and Marsha Orgeron. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
I'd imagine that schools were a major part of the market for educational films. Were they shown anywhere else, Marsha?
Yeah, they were showed in many, many different venues besides the theatrical ones. They were showed at businesses. They were showed at various kind of clubs, fraternal organizations, churches, any place you could imagine that had a message, an idea that they wanted to convey, something they wanted to teach, something they wanted to persuade someone of. That is a place that would have a film made or make a film and then show it in order to bring people into the fold.
Well, were they produced by educators or by organizations and people who had a message that they wanted to pass on to the kids?
Well, it really depended upon the context. I mean, there was a time in this country where it seemed like almost everyone was in the educational motion picture production business, including the major studios, but also, you know, the American government was a huge producer, Department of Agriculture, the military. Educators were involved as consultants and also as producers. There were major universities that had educational film production units, and then there were lots of private enterprises as well that would consult with educators.
Yeah, and probably the names that people today might remember, like Encyclopedia Britannica films, those come after World War II in large part because of the mass success of the war effort being using educational film.
Well, is calling all of them educational the most accurate way to describe them?
I would say that it's accurate in the general sense, but yeah, it probably gives a bit of a misnomer if you only think of them as classroom films with didactic narration. The variety is quite stunning, and the quality of the films ranges from, you know, excellent masterpiece to the most boring kind of thing.
And were there attempts to make them entertaining, or was this very much cod liver oil?
There were always debates from the very beginning in the teens and 20s about that very obstacle, how to make things engaging, entertaining was often that word. But that's kind of the rhetoric of educational film. What's entertaining, what's educational, how can we do both?
Well, weren't teachers warned at one point about using films as entertainment or as an educational pacifier? I guess this is the same sort of thing we were worried about later when we put kids in front of TV sets, Devin.
Great amount of debate during these years about how much so-called entertainment could be allowed to kind of slip into the pedagogical mission of these works. And one of the kind of interesting things I think culturally that was happening during the sort of heyday of the educational film movement is that a lot of people caught wind of the fact that there was this kind of wave that could be ridden. And so one of the things that ended up occurring is that a lot of people with kind of commercial interests, people that were manufacturing products or selling services, would use the idea or the buzzword of education to basically make advertisements. And a lot of these advertisements would also find their way into classrooms and churches and conventions in kind of interesting ways. And the material itself is often quite beautiful and quite remarkable from a filmmaking as well as a pedagogical standpoint, but the sort of initiative behind them sometimes is a bit questionable.
Are they totally American? Were there educational films made in other parts of the world as well?
Absolutely. Our book deals exclusively with American educational film, but there were movements very similar to this one all over the world.
Marsha, when were they first produced? Were any made during the silent era?
Oh, yes. There is a long tradition, and in our book we have several chapters that deal with some of the earlier silent era films, including Thomas Edison. We have a chapter in the book that talks about that some of the films made for the Edison Company that had to do with health education, for example. The Ford Motor Company made films about Americanization, for example. So, yes, there's a long legacy. This is virtually, you know, cinema was born in part out of an educative function. So trying to study motion and think about kind of scientific issues. And so this kind of gets carried forth. And there's a question from the beginning about, is film going to be a medium of entertainment, or is it going to be a medium of education? And it seemed for a while that education was really the direction it was going.
Dan, don't you teach cinema studies at NYU, where you're also associate director of the Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program?
Guilty.
So should I be alarmed that the chapter you wrote for this book is called The Failure of the NYU Educational Film Institute? Is it politic to criticize your own school?
Well, that seems the most obvious title to give it, because the institute was a failure that only lasted about 18 months, but there actually is a celebratory legacy, because it started an educational film library which served a whole generation of basically national distribution.
Well, there seems to be a renewed interest in these films, even though they're not made anymore. Do any schools have courses about educational films?
Yeah, I think in part because of not only renewed interest among people in general, but scholars have, in the past, let's say, decade or so, started to take up all kinds of non-Hollywood, non-feature films, and not just documentaries, but all kinds of so-called non-theatrical films. And educational films were just one of the biggest categories. So I know Marcia and Devin have both taught courses. I've taught them in my courses. Well, many of our authors have.
I would assume that their emphasis would be on the sociological and political implications of these films.
Yeah, that's generally the case. But we also try to integrate them into other aspects of cinema itself. But it's certainly true that the social and political context is most important.
Devin, did any notable filmmakers get their starts in educational films? Any whose names we might recognize?
Absolutely. Actually, the chapter that I contribute to the book is focused on a pretty remarkable figure in American film history, Edgar Ulmer, who's an Austrian-born Poverty Row B filmmaker who seemed poised for success and then kind of famously fell from grace, only to find himself making occasional masterpieces like Detour from 1945, but supplementing his filmmaking interest and his finances, making educational films, advertisements, and promotional material.
And but also Yiddish language films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so he basically carved out this kind of alternate Hollywood career that absolutely found him at the foreground of educational filmmaking.
Well, would we recognize a signature style when we see his film Goodbye, Mr. Germ? Would we say that's the same filmmaker who made Detour?
I think that that's a bit of a stretch. I think largely because these films were so guided by the organizations that produced them. But you can, you know, if pressed, you can sort of detect what look like sort of expressionist techniques in these films. But for the most part, what I think is most readily apparent is a kind of a thematic interest of Ulmer's in sort of writing what he considered to be kind of the racial wrongs in the country at the time. And also, I think, a sort of abiding interest in the idea of fate, which is something that pops up in pretty much every Edgar Ulmer film, and it certainly appears with great frequency in his work for the National Tuberculosis Association.
Well, we can't show it, but we could play a clip from Goodbye, Mr. Germ. Is there anything we need to know before we listen to this?
Well, it's kind of an odd setup. This is it's a film focused on these two very bored young children on a rainy day who are surprised that their father can take solace and interest in something as old-fashioned as a book. The book itself causes the father to hallucinate a situation where he's invented a germ radio so that he can talk directly to Mr. Germ of the film's title, who also goes by the name TB.
Okay, let's listen to the clip.
Hello, hello, TV.
Why, hello there, Professor.
Well, well, there you are. Tell us about yourself.
Sure, I love to talk about myself. Exciting, full of adventure. Your incubator up there is a pretty snug place for an old-timer like me, Professor. But I remember, when I was a youngster, I lived in the lung of a nice lady, Aunt Matilda.
Well, I'm not sure that that style of acting would have gone over very well in a Hollywood film, but the point is made. Marcia, what role did educational films play in the 60s during the time of the civil rights protests? And I wonder whether the Vietnam War was ever addressed.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different... Obviously, one of the things that's interesting about looking at educational films is they really chart major moments of social change. And, apropos of your question, the chapter I contribute to the book is about this time period, and it's particularly about issues of race and of the city and of integration. And, you know, in the 1950s, there's very few films that even address the topic of race for the classroom. It's kind of a absent topic. And when it does come up, it's really a kind of Brown versus Board of Education integrationist message that you have films made really targeted at white students about tolerance and about accepting people who are different than you, but they're typically a little abstract. And that all changes in the 1960s, and you get a kind of first generation of films that are directly about race. And I think they're motivated in partly because of what was happening with the kind of creation of ghetto cultures, where there were really kind of pockets of impoverished communities. And I talk about the context of riot-era America, where there's all of this national concern, and President Johnson, this was a major concern for him about kind of controlling racial violence in this country. So you begin to get films that actually talk about what it means to be African-American and in this country.
And you've asked us to play a clip from a film called Sonny.
It's actually called 220 Blues, but Sonny is the main character.
Okay, and it turns out the quality of it isn't perfect, but we'll probably get a pretty good idea. This is about a black track athlete at a time of integration?
Yeah, he is basically an African-American student who is integrated very nicely into his suburban school until an older African-American student joins the school. And this student, Larry, is a separatist and an activist, and he's very articulate, and he has very compelling arguments that Sonny kind of has to listen to and reckon with that have to do with what it means to be black in a white society. And he really kind of disrupts the status quo. And this is an unusual and interesting film because it does air those views of black separatism, which you don't in a positive way.
That ain't black shoe polish you got on, is it, man?
No, man, what you trying to say?
Well, man, I'm a little concerned about you spending so much time with the white boy over there.
Maybe
you mess with your brothers. You should be messing with your brothers, man.
Look, man, we just run track, that's all.
Man, I can dig that, but you spend so much time with that white boy, you know, taking a big chance there.
No, man, it can't be nothing but a friend, you know, we just run track.
No, a friend. Man, you know what a friend is? Man, a friend is a reflection of yourself.
Uh-huh.
Your alter ego, a mirror.
Oh,
you
right.
See in your friend things you want to be like.
So what you're trying to say is that I want to be white.
You said it, man.
Look,
what are the reason is it?
Look, maybe I see something that, maybe I see a good track, man.
Actually, it sounds to me like the acting and the writing there are quite sophisticated.
It's actually a very sophisticated film. I interviewed the writer for this film, Ed Limbacher, to talk to him about it because it's such an unusual film. And I think that was maybe a little bit hard to hear across the board. But basically this conversation is, you know, the older student saying, look, you're trying to be white. And the integrated student saying, you know, maybe this is just about running track, but it does make him have to think about what it means, you know, to be an athlete and to think about going to college on a scholarship and what it means to have those kind of obligations and how you're accepted as an African-American in American culture.
Now, Dan, you wanted us to highlight a film called Valley Town, A Study of Machines and Men. Wasn't the end of this film censored originally?
Yes, exactly. So we're going to listen to the end of the censored version because both versions survive. The censored version is about 10 minutes shorter, and the intervention was made directly by the funder of the project, Alfred Sloan, who was then the chairman of General Motors but also had recently founded the Sloan Foundation to educate American public about economics. And this is what he thought the Educational Film Institute at NYU was going to do, was educate everyday people about economics, of course, in the midst of the Depression. So Valley Town was one of three films produced in 1940 by the Institute, directed by Willard Van Dyke, who was a major documentary filmmaker at the time. The year before had directed The City, which millions of people saw at the World's Fair in New York. So he was, you know, a top documentarian of the time, not just an educational
filmmaker.
And
why did they censor it?
The script was quite propagandistic. We would call it in our day very much pro-labor. And so the narrator that we'll hear is supposed to be the mayor of this unnamed valley town, essentially a steel town in Pennsylvania. And machines have thrown lots of men out of work. And so the mayor has this harangue against business, which was eliminated.
They say they're tearing down the mill soon. Why, if that was so, I know then someday he'd walk right out of here and never come back to us again. Tell me, where is that place with work and joy?
Well, obviously that's not the mayor, but that's from another part of the film. Were many of them musicals?
No, very rare. But yes, that's part of what makes this film interesting. Actually, part of that musical number was also censored because the lyrics are also very much from a working-class perspective. And as you can tell, the music is quite unusual. It's actually written by Mark Blitzstein, the writer of The Cradle Will Rock, famous composer of the time, and a kind of disciple of Brecht, which is why the films have this art song quality. So very weird to come in the middle of an educational film. But both some of that and the ending where Ray Collins, the mayor, harangues, both censored.
Now, these films are often can be seen during the Orphan Film Symposium. Those are biannual. When's the next one?
The next one will be in April 2014 in Amsterdam. The National Film Museum there is hosting it. But we're also doing a kind of a slightly miniature version of it, but fairly substantial, at Indiana University next year.
I'm assuming that some of these films, like films in general, are not always in the best condition. Is it hard to get them restored? Because I would assume preservationists are reluctant to spend limited resources on saving educational films when there are so many important feature films that need their attention.
Yeah, it's true. And a lot of the work at just not necessarily doing high-end restoration, but literally just saving them from dumpsters, has been done by private collectors. Skip Eltzheimer, who contributes to our book and has a collection of tens of thousands of these films, and he actually right now has an online campaign to help digitize and make them accessible. So our mission has been to make all the films in the book that we could find available online.
Well, some of them are quite funny, like Squeak the Squirrel, which we have posted online on our website at WNYC.org. My great thanks to the three of you for being on our show, Dan Schiebel, Devin, and Marsha Orgeron. The book they've edited is called Learning with the Lights Off, Educational Film in the United States, and it's published by Oxford University Press.